Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus. Today, we travel the Tree of Worlds and visit the Temple of the Muses. And Nick Curto proudly presents The Creative Process. Greetings and welcome, Nick Curto. How are you?
Oh, never better, Hercules. Thank you so much for asking. And yourself?
I'm doing phenomenally well. I'm going to be a grandfather soon. So that's like a really awesome thing. And I'm greatly looking forward to that chapter of my life beginning.
That is going to be fantastic. I'm very happy for you. And for the baby.
Yes. So one day we might visit you guys, me with my stroller, with my grandson.
Wow.
And I'm looking forward to your show today because you have a special guest. You have Hal Rainbow on. I'm so looking forward to that.
Okay, well, here we go then. This is a live podcast program. The title, as you know, is Nick Curto Presents The Creative Process, and I'm Nick Curto, your host. A very brief background about yours truly. I can never remember a time when I wasn't creative, highly creative in my life, right from the very, very beginning. As a child, I was doing drawings and paintings, constructing small sculptures. I wrote, directed, and produced puppet shows starting in grade school. My father built a puppet stage out of plywood, and he would drive me with it, unload it, and we would bring it into the school, and a few of my fellow students would act it out with puppets. I attended the George Walter Vincent Smith Museum art classes in Springfield, Massachusetts, and I attended the Technical High School where I excelled in art and was a member of the drama club and acted in school shows. Now, before graduation from high school, I searched for an art college to apply to, and my very first choice was the Massachusetts College of Art and Design in Boston. That was the one and truly the only art college that I really wanted to attend. Over 1,000 students had applied to get in, and I knew that only 200 applicants were going to be chosen. I waited for that reply to see if my application would be accepted after I had traveled to the college in Boston and to show my portfolio of my art and design work to the college staff in that early spring. Well, here it goes. It took some time, but that letter from the Massachusetts College of Art finally arrived at my family home. I remember quickly saying a prayer and took a very deep breath and opened it. It read that I had indeed been accepted and was to report in September to start my freshman first class. It was quite a moment in my life. And a turning point, truly a turning point also. Mass art was all that I had ever dreamed that it could be, and much, much more. I made incredible friends, which I still have to this day, and is a very, very loving place in my heart for that amazing, amazing school. Now, I now live in Manhattan, and I've been here a good part of my life, and I have worked in art and design all my life here in New York City. Now, get this, I'm currently the chair of my Massachusetts College of Art, a class of 66, and I'm now working on our 55th year reunion to be held this coming fall by way of a Zoom party celebration. Wow, time flies.
Wow.
Okay, now my featured guest for this evening on this live podcast program is my colleague and my longtime partner as well, Hal Rainbow. A very warm welcome to you, Hal.
Hi, it's good to be here.
And yes, folks, Rainbow is really Hal's last name. It really is. What a great name.
Yes, even though people have questioned it since I was a kid.
I can imagine. I certainly can imagine. I want to do a very, very brief introduction to you, of you, for the listeners tonight. Hal works with the Department of Education. He is a writer, a member of the Urantia Society of Greater New York, and he also is the current president. Also, he is a puppeteer, and he has been a puppeteer all his life. Hal, you've a very busy person indeed when it comes to the wonderful world of creativity. I know that for a fact. You are involved in so many aspects of the creative expression experience. I love the fact that you don't limit yourself to just one category of creativity.
Thank you.
I would like to ask you right from the very start, if we could, first, where were you born?
I was born in Staten Island, New York, and I lived there throughout most of college, and then I moved around the country for a while with work, and now I'm back in Staten Island.
Were you from a very big family with brothers and sisters?
Not that big a family. I have two sisters, both older.
Okay, well, that's a big family with a lot of challenges. You being the baby of the of the family with two older sisters. Oh, boy, you did well. You did well.
Oh, and just
now,
so
what
you know, the youngest child syndrome does not exist. We all got in trouble equally.
Okay. Well, that's a very good admission on your part. Now, tell us a little bit about your mom and dad. What were they like, briefly?
My mom was a school teacher, and she wasn't a participant in the arts, but she was always – a major fan of them. She liked the opera. She liked the opera, the ballet. She kept subscriptions to different theaters to see what's current. So she's had a really good time with the arts. She's an avid reader. My father worked as a retailer. We had a curtain and drape store. So that took up like 90% of his time. And growing up, everybody worked in the store at one point of another. And he was a pretty cool guy. He liked restaurants and wines and things like that. So it was a very, you know, it was a very comfortable childhood.
I'm glad to hear that. Now, were there any other members of your family tree that were creative? Your grandparents on either side, or cousins, or aunts or uncles, anything like that?
Not really. My grandfather, gourmet cook, but in terms of creativity, they were pretty down to earth crew.
Did they encourage you on your creative interests?
Fortunately, my grandparents had all died when I was young. My parents, I don't know if they were happy about the creative interest, but they certainly didn't stop it, and they certainly encouraged it. When I first got my first big puppeteering job and was going to go out on tour, my father wanted to see what I could do, and he was looking at it, and then he turned to my mom and said, so he graduated with honors with an English degree from college. Jenny plays with dolls for a living. So he had a pretty good sense of humor about it.
Wow. I guess so. Did they actually see you doing puppetry during that time? Did they have an idea of what it was like?
Yes, they had a very good idea. They would come to some shows to see them. And just to get an idea of what it was, my mom put up a lot of time with helping me learn scripts. But, yeah, they used to like to go to the shows, see what was up, because some of the shows changed very drastically. You know, time went on. So they enjoyed
them.
I'm
sorry, go ahead.
No, I had finished. I just said they enjoyed them.
Right. I'm really, really happy to hear that. My dad, I remember, bought plywood and built me a puppet stage, and it was a marionette. It was a marionette type of a stage, and so I was using marionettes as opposed to hand puppets when I was doing the various shows I was doing. And I remember my mother at that time got some maroon material, silk, maroon, and stitched up in her Singer sewing machine curtains that would open and close for my puppet theater. And I love them so much. And for them to do that for me, I always will remember with fond memories that they really did contribute to that, my interest. And I am forever grateful that I was blessed. It was really such wonderful parents. They were very encouraging. They really were. My dad was actually, he sang and he danced in minstrel shows put on by Our Lady of Mount Carmel Church. And I remember going to some of the minstrel shows, and my dad was there on stage doing numbers. And I remember, wow, I couldn't believe that. My mother told me that she actually was in a chorus line when she was a girl, and she actually showed me some of the steps and sang me some of the songs that she did on stage briefly. I guess it was for a high school, probably was, but anyhow, but those are really good memories that I really do cherish. Now, creative background, did you also do any drawing or painting or constructions of any kind besides your puppetry?
The puppetry, that's been the main focus. And like you, my parents bought my sister a puppet stage, and she had no interest in it, so I just took it over as a kid. And that's how that side decided. But for a while, I worked for a company, and I designed dolls for them.
Oh.
We had agreed with this company they would never be baby dolls, and they would be kind of weird offshoots of fairy tales. So the company had a nickname of Life's Tough in the Forest. And I cannot draw to save my life. I would draw strict stick figures of what the doll should look like, which went over really well with the sculpting people. And then they would sculpt them, and I would then costume them. But it was a lot of fun to design these guys. I said they were just strange versions of fairy tales, like a wall hanging of Rapunzel leading over the banister and the prince hanging free, holding onto her hair, except Rapunzel had a look of absolute agony on her face. And then
were they made of wood, or what was the construction
no,
like for
they
those?
Were, they were made of polymer clay.
I'm sorry,
the woman
what is
who
that
was,
again?
They were made of polymer clay. It's a kind of synthetic clay. And then the woman who sculpted them was fantastic. She really could get facial expressions beautifully.
And they were sold in stores?
They were sold in stores, and they were sold at doll collector shows.
Fantastic.
And then I also worked for a while at the New York Renaissance Fair. And we made dragons. We made fully articulated dragons that could ride on your shoulder and do different poses. And then I decided one year that they should become the Barbies of fantasy. So they started having wizard costumes and Batman costumes and full leather biker costumes. And they just became a lot of fun to work with and make and build for people to give their dragons clothes.
Now, for those listeners who haven't heard of the Renaissance Fair, could you give us a little bit of a description of what it was like and what it entailed and what was there and what was the entertainment like? Because I think that'd be of interest.
Okay, the Renaissance Fair, at least the one in Tuxedo, it was a series of shows. They had an official court, the king, the queen, Robin Hood, various other characters, and you could follow this play throughout the entire field of what, you know, the length of the Renaissance stadiums. They had living chess games, they had duels, they had Robin Hood and Little John meet at the bridge, so there was that theatrical going on. And then there was a lot of side theatricals. There was a marionette company, there was an improv company, there was this one wonderful group called Shakespeare on the Grovel, and they looked like muddy beggars, And if you gave them a dollar, they would grovel for a while in front of anyone you wanted. Just a wonderfully hysterical thing. And then they also had people selling all sorts of things, mostly medieval-related jewelry and writing and toys and armor, all sorts. It ran the gamut, all sorts of things. It was pretty great. And the Renaissance Fair is still going on. I think it's like it's in its 25th or 26th year right now.
Wow. And you said that was in Tuxedo, New York. Is that correct?
Right. It's right by Bear Mountain.
Timing on that. Would it be summer, or just a week or a month or 2 months of the summer? What was the running time?
It usually runs weekends from the end of July till a couple of weeks after Labor Day. And what always amazed me about this was you'd have people coming in all sorts of costumes, both realistic medieval and real fantasy medieval. But a lot of these people, it's the middle of August, and they're dressed in brocades and things like that and armor. I always was amazed that they could just not collapse in the middle of it. Oh, and the highlight of the fair, of course, was the jousting.
Tell us about that.
They had professional jousters who would come in, and they would show up. They would be part of the court scenes, and then at the end of the show, the highlight was these four or five jousters would hold a tournament for the Queen's honor. And it was really amazing to watch because they were wearing plate. These were pretty big horses they were on, charging at each other. It was jousting rules. You know, the lances were dulled, of course, but they knock you off that horse. You could see they felt it. It was a very exciting thing to watch.
I can imagine. The time that I did go with you to that fair, as you said, I was so impressed with all the people that actually dressed in the period outfits, men and women, and they really acted the part. If it was warm, they had fans, and the women would fan themselves, and the dresses were sometimes very heavy material, very authentic looking. And on a warm day, I mean, I give them a lot of credit for pulling that off. And also, I really enjoyed the fact that they were acting as they would way back when. At that time, their manners and the way they talked, they were really trying to do like a time warp to be in that time. And I love the fact that they did that. It was an amazing experience to do that. I hope to go there again and see it again, because it was really something.
And, well, that's certainly something we could easily do. But the most amazing thing is for these actors, they never broke character.
Exactly. Exactly right. And that was amazing, because you really did feel like you were there, like you were in a different time that they were active. And they really did pull it off really well. I also want to ask you, in the Renaissance Fair, you mentioned that there was a puppet show. What kind of puppet show was it? Did they do there?
The company was called the Binghamton Marionettes. They were an old established company, Bennington Marionettes, I'm sorry. They're an established company. They would do epic theater, such as the story of Siegfried or some of the Russian fairy tales. And their puppet stage was a two-sided stage. There was a stage in front and a stage in back. And the puppeteers were about a good 15 feet off the air, where the puppeteers stand. It was a marionette stage. And then there were times you had to get the puppet, such as the Phoenix, from the front stage to the backstage. So you ended up getting momentum and then flinging the puppet from one stage to the other. What made it, quote unquote, exciting was there were no guardrails on this bridge you were standing on. So you really had to have good balance. But
did anyone ever lose their balance during a performance?
On that stage, no. There were some other shows I've worked on where people did walk off the bridge accidentally.
Whoops.
Yeah,
boy, that must have been so. Wow. Although it wasn't a laughing matter at the time. I'm sure.
As long as nobody got hurt. Luckily, the Bennington Marionettes, if you fell off that bridge, you would have been badly hurt. Some of the other companies I've worked with, the bridges were only maybe 4 or 5 feet off the ground, so it wasn't as dangerous.
I also want to ask you, did they pre-record the a track of the actors' voices and from a script, or did they do it live?
It was both. When it was outdoor theater, it was pre-recorded. When I first started working for the Niccolo Marionettes, it was all live. So that, you know, you were given a script. There were microphones along the edge of the puppet rail, which is where you can rest your hands when you're working the puppets. But after a while, we pre-recorded it because you got more consistency in the soundtrack. And also, if you had to change a puppeteer at last notice, you didn't have to worry about the voice fitting. So it made for a better production.
Sure, I could really understand that. And the other part of that too, working a puppet, a marionette, is a full-time job in the sense that you've got to be there every second with the movements following the script, where you'd have to be on stage in a particular place with your puppet, so forth. But to also live read scripts is a whole other thing. So if anybody had the talent to do both at the same time, my hat's off to them, because I think that would be incredibly difficult to do. Would you agree?
It is difficult, but you had to think of it as a regular theater production. You memorized your script, you memorized your part, you had your puppets that were, you know, doing regular entrances and exits and acting. It was a full regular production that you would go to see on any stage. The difference is you had to convey your emotions through more motion, and you had to be more careful with your actions. There couldn't be as many big, wide actions unless you need them, and you had to remember that if you're laughing or something that happens on the bridge, your puppet looks a little bit like it has epilepsy as the... as the strings move up and down. So you have to be very aware of what you were doing with your puppets.
I can imagine. I can imagine that's true. Wow. Now tell us now, so at what point did you become a professional puppeteer? And I believe you toured. Tell us all about that.
As I tell people, I use the Shirley MacLaine version of becoming a puppeteer. I saw a puppet show when I was in the 5th grade, and it just amazed me. And then I decided I wanted to work with puppets, and I went on some auditions, and I found one theater that I was working at, and I was doing more backstage or, you know, cleanup work and such like that. And literally somebody didn't show, and the director of the company said, "You've been around here long enough. I've seen you. You can work the puppets. You've got about 20 minutes to learn the script, and then you're performing." Now, luckily, I'm a very quick study with scripts, and I had the puppet, and okay, the puppet didn't really touch the ground anywhere as much as it should, and there were other mistakes. And the director of the company, he was nervous about the change, and he pulled me aside and had a couple of lovely things to say about me and my ability and what I really should be doing with my life. And then later on, when I had gone home, I got a phone call, and he basically was saying, "You're either crazy to do it that way or you've got some real talent. I'd like you to go on tour with the shows." Yeah. So
wow.
That's sort of my Shirley MacLaine start. But as it turned out, the puppet show that I saw in the 5th grade was the same company that I ended up working for. And actually I saw the director of the company performing the show. So it was kind of cool.
What company name was that?
The company was named the Niccolo Marionettes. And they had been performing since 1939.
Are they still around? Are they still exist?
They changed hands, and for a long time they were known as Puppet Work. And they also toured, and then they had a permanent stage in Brooklyn. And to the best of my knowledge, it's been a while, they still, the tours don't go out, but they still do have the regular puppet theater in Brooklyn. And I highly recommend people going to see shows. They're top-notch professional shows.
Fantastic. That sounds wonderful. And are they the same company that was performing puppetry at Christmas time at Macy's? Are we sticking to the same group?
Yes, they performed. They did the Macy's show, and I did some of those shows, and it was, you did 10 shows a day. They were about 20 minutes long, but still, it was 10 shows a day.
Wow.
So you really got to work out.
That is quite a schedule. That really is quite a schedule. And was it every hour you did a 20-minute show? Was it scheduled like that?
No, the times would vary.
Okay.
It wasn't an hourly thing. It was set up different times throughout the day to correspond with what was going on in Santa Land.
Okay. That makes total sense. Now, tell us about the actual process of doing a traveling puppet show. Where did you travel? How many puppeteers were there? What were the shows like? What happened? I'd love to know all of that, please.
Okay, on these particular tours, you traveled by van. There were three people in the tours, and you rehearsed the show for probably 2 or 3 weeks so you were ready to go. Everything, you basically traveled with two shows in one van. So 1 year we did Rumpelstiltskin and Sleeping Beauty, so that a lot of the puppets were interchangeable. And some of the sets were interchangeable, but you traveled with a full proscenium stage so that you went into a school or a theater or wherever you were playing. You set up the stage, which was a metal bridge, the full proscenium, the stage, the lights, the sound. It literally was a full theater stage. And
wow,
that could take easily an hour and a half. Then you'd have a show. Then you'd have downtime, then you'd do another show, and then you'd reverse the process, break the whole thing down, and then drive to the next location. Sometimes you did two shows at two different places in one day, and then tour book, so you knew where you were going for, you knew where you were going when. You were probably on the road for 4 or 5 months. And you played everything from national theaters to little small off-the-beaten-path towns where the town square literally was a park with the city hall on one end and the library on the other, and everything was around a square. So you got to see amazing parts of the country.
And what states did you tour when you did that? What states?
We started from New York going down to Florida, and then you wandered through Alabama, Mississippi, Ohio, Kentucky, Oklahoma, Texas, back up through Michigan, Wisconsin, a tour of the Northeast, and then you came back. So I've probably seen a good half to three quarters of the country through this job.
That is incredibly
ambitious. And
that
was amazing. And you were traveling in a van with two other people. Mm-hmm. And by the end of the tour, the van was getting very crowded with things you bought along the line.
And did you then go into a motel or a small hotel for the night? Is that how you did it?
Right. If you had per diem. And every night you would stay in a hotel, or if you knew somebody, you may stay in their house, or sometimes the sponsors invited you to stay. But it was generally drive to a hotel or a motel, spend the night there, do the shows, pack up, drive to the next hotel or motel. And sometimes we were very lucky. In fact, the producers were very nice about it. we would get, if we were in Orlando or that area, we'd get 2 or 3 days off so we could go to Disney World or have a couple of days off that we could go to New Orleans. The basic rule was you were responsible to be at the performance site at whatever time you were responsible to get there. How and when you did it was your business, but you were there on time.
Were the puppeteers strictly male, or was it a combination of male and female puppeteers that were touring?
No, it was different mixes.
Okay.
Originally, it was
any romances along the way?
I'm sorry?
Were there any romances along the way?
Yes, that did happen on occasion. There were some people. There were people who went out on tour. One tour came back with the couple, with a couple engaged.
Oh.
And which was really nice. There was one instance where we were a very tight-knit group. One of the guys, we went to stay with his family. We were there for about 3 or 4 days, and the guy's little younger sister and I hit it off. So, you know, we went out a couple of times, and all of a sudden it went from, this is the guy I'm working with, to, wait a minute, this is some guy dating my younger sister. So things went back and forth.
Wow. quite a dynamic, that's for sure. Tell me, during all this time of traveling and such an aggressive schedule and so many things could go right or wrong, I bet you there were some things that went really far afield and went quite wrong at the obviously the worst possible times. Can you give us a couple of examples of that? Do you remember?
I'm happy to say they were few and far between.
Good.
They were very few and far between. Most everything went off very, very smoothly. I think the two strangest ones, all these shows, you have to remember, were booked a year or over a year in advance.
Okay.
So we went to one site, and I called up my boss because I was the road manager on that tour. And I said, you know, we have a problem. The school isn't here. And he was saying, oh, they had a day off, and I guess they didn't tell us. And I said, no, you don't understand. The school isn't here. And again, it went back and forth for a while so that I could get through to him. The school, the building was gone. Somewhere time period from the booking of the show, they knocked down the school. So there was no school.
So you went to the location and there was nothing there.
Right.
Wow.
There literally was nothing there.
Oh, boy. Ouch. That hurts.
Ouch,
that must have hurt. Any
yeah,
other?
It,
you said there
it
were
hurt,
a couple.
It was kind of funny.
Yeah. Now it's funny. Perhaps that
now
moment it wasn't as funny. Any other one? You said there were a couple.
There was one other, and this was a disaster. I'm almost horrified to tell this story. We were taking the shows from, it was supposed to end up in Vermont. I'm not sure exactly where we started. It was about 2 hours away, and there was a horrible accident where the engine of the truck caught fire. Luckily, Luckily, everybody got out of the van in time, so nobody was hurt. But unfortunately, the truck burnt, and there was extensive, a show burnt with it. But I cannot thank the highway patrol enough. They came by to see if everyone was okay. And then, as they would ask, they said, is everybody okay? And all of us started to giggle like we were a little crazy, and I think they figured we were in shock. But, we were thinking, well, do we tell them Mother, Father, Hansel, Gretel, the witch didn't get out? it was just sort of those 2 in the morning crazinesses.
Mm-hmm.
But
for the most part,
I'm happy to say most everything else worked like clockwork, and the shows were really fantastic.
I bet they were. I wish I could have witnessed them and enjoyed them. I really do, because I do enjoy that type of entertainment very much. I've seen some wonderful puppets. I remember when I was a kid on black and white TV in the morning show, they had Bill and Cora Bear marionettes there, and they were doing the marionettes were doing performances of recorded hit songs of the time, and they had singing frogs, and they had other, I think, rabbits and other kinds of animals singing these popular songs. And I believe they were all hand puppets at the time, not marionettes, but hand puppets. And I, as a kid, loved to get up in the morning to see what Bill and Cora Baird from New York City were doing with their puppetry. And I understand that they actually had a theater in the West Village. I can't remember. Was it Barrow Street?
It was the Barrow Street Theater. They were brilliant.
Absolutely were. And they were a big hit on TV. They also had a lion puppet. I think his name was Charlemagne. And he had a sense of humor. And it was a delight to see them in the morning on one of the morning shows. I believe Dave Garraway, I believe at the time that he was the host for the morning program. And boy, I look forward to those puppet shows very, very much. They still stand out to me as some of the more wonderful, fun, creative puppet shows I've ever seen. I'm only sad that I wasn't old enough and in New York City to have gone to their theater and see it live. I would love to have seen that, and of course I couldn't. I know that on YouTube they do have some of the Bill and Cora Baird marionettes luckily preserved on film, and you can still see a few of those performances on YouTube. And I would just say to our listeners that I highly recommend that you take a look at that, because I think you'll be delighted of the creativity that Bill and Cora Baird had. They were really quite a team.
Most of the work, like the Bairds, Howdy Doody, a lot of the shows that are done in Central Park, it's a matter of doesn't this look simple? Doesn't this look easy? And you do not know the amount of blood, sweat, and tears that goes into it.
Oh, I bet. I can imagine. And that's another one of a Howdy Doody. When I was a kid, watching the Howdy Doody show was something every single day, weekday. We would absolutely look forward to that show. I remember, and Buffalo Bob Smith, and he wore kind of a pioneer kind of outfit, although it was looked like it was just cloth. But he would be the one standing beside the puppet stage, and he would be talking to Howdy Doody, and they would they had a whole series of other wonderful characters. Do you remember any of those characters?
I should. I don't. Princess Summer, Winter, Spring, Fall.
That was the live actress playing Princess Summer, Fall, Winter, Spring.
Oh,
also,
I think they had
Clarabelle Clown, who was also a real-life actor dressed as a clown, and he would interact with Buffalo Bob Smith and Howdy Doody and the other cast members of the puppet show. They had another puppet named Flubadub, which was, I believe, a combination of a duck and a couple of other animal parts in this kind of fanciful character. I believe the name was Flubadub, and these were wonderful characters. I do remember this with a great love and excitement, because that was such a wonderful part of growing up and seeing that.
I was very lucky also in that the puppeteer who worked those puppets, a man named Patty Black, fortunately he's passed on, but he was the puppeteer for that show. He was one of the people who taught me how to work marionettes. Now, of course, the big trivia question for Howdy Doody is, what color was his original hair? Or originally, what color was Howdy Doody's hair?
Mm-hmm. Red?
Blonde.
What was it?
It was blonde originally, and then they got a second puppet.
You know, for one Christmas, I got a Howdy Doody marionette. I haven't thought of that in a very long time, but I remember it. One Christmas, that's what my Christmas present was, a Howdy Doody puppet marionette. I do remember that. And if I recall, the actor who played Clarabelle on the Howdy Doody show went on to be the McDonald's clown. Is that correct? Do you remember that?
I thought he was connected with Captain Kangaroo, but I could be wrong about
oh,
that.
Oh, you might. Okay, no, you might be right. I'm not sure about that now. But it seems to me as though he looked very similar, for sure. So there was a connection. There was a connection like that. So, see, now what else can we discuss about this? You had traveled so much. Oh, I know. You and I wrote and produced a puppet show a few years ago here in New York City. Why don't you tell us the title and what that was about? I think that would be of interest.
The title of the show was Rainbow's Journey, and it was produced with the Fresh Fruit Festival, which is a festival of gay, lesbian, transgender arts, all different types, music, plays, film, musicals, and we produced a children's puppet show. And the idea was that to teach different types of tolerances. So it was the story of two children who go on this adventure, and each separate little adventure they have is a different color of the rainbow flag. And there's one land where they have to guess riddles. There's one land where they have to outsmart a shark. There's one land where they have to help a dragon solve its major problems. And the main characters in the show were a little black boy, a little white girl, and a slightly insane squirrel.
and their parents were friends, and they were having a picnic in the park. That's what the story, how it ran. And the children wanted to explore a waterfall. And when they got to the waterfall in the park, they realized that they could actually get behind the waterfall, and we had a fairly large metal, blue metal waterfall that was shimmering and going. And when the children went behind the waterfall, that's when they found all the colors of the gay flag, and each color was a different land. And they, in their journey to try to get back to their parents in the park, they had to go through these various lands, and each land was a different color, of the gay flag. And as you said, each of those lands had a, I'll call it a monster or something they had to get past to continue on their journey. So there was lots of challenges along the way. And finally, they did do that. They got back out of the waterfall, behind the waterfall. They were back in the, and they joined their loving parents. And that's how it ended. And we deliberately wrote that for the gay community. And we also wrote that showing that black families and white families were very much friends and had wonderful children and got together and went on picnics. And I think that there was a lot of good messages there within the script. I'm very proud of that particular script. And we eventually performed it, if you remember, at the Gay Center on West 13th Street. And we had a fairly large stage that we built, and we had a sound and lighting engineer. And we had, I believe that was all pre-recorded, Hal, wasn't it?
Yes, that was pre-recorded because, again, there were some flippant puppeteers in the course of the show. So that removed that problem. And also, the nice thing about a pre-recorded show is you can find the exact voices that work.
Exactly.
It was like back
and,
when I was first touring and we were doing classic fairy tales. You could, when they became pre-recorded, you literally could find the perfect voice.
I love doing that, having a session where you read the script and you get really good actors to be the various colorful voices as the story unfolds. And I love that process. And we had some wonderful people that worked with us on that production, and I'm very proud of that production. And one little note here is that I had never been a puppeteer with a full script before, and it got to be very much a problem in that these puppets, although they weren't really heavy, they did have some weight to them, and you have to keep your hands up above the curtain, the base curtain, and you had to keep your hands up in the hand puppets, and my hands and arms became incredibly tired and actually painful. And I had to think of something to help me, because I had some very long scenes with the puppets that I was working, and I decided to get some sticks, very long sticks, about maybe 5 or 6 feet, and I tied them to my elbows with a string, and then I could rest my hand on the string, and then the board would hit the floor, so that I had a resting place, and when the puppets would move on the stage, I could then make believe the puppet was walking, and the stick would move with me. And that was a saving grace that I did, because I was desperate. My arms and my hands were killing me because of the weight. I'll never forget that.
Yeah, that takes a lot of getting used to. It's good exercise.
I have a lot of respect for puppeteers that can do that without my little invention of big sticks holding up my arms and the puppet.
I also like the fact, Nick, that you fell into it's not the oldest thing in the book, but it's very close. You were working with the puppet, and then you looked and said, oh, so the best thing the puppet could do here is smile. And my comment was, sure. Make them smile. These are traditional hand puppets. They're your actions. They can't smile.
Right. And the moment you said that, I went, oh, my God, you're right. I couldn't do facial movements for the puppets that we had. I do remember that. Another thing we did that I loved is that we tried this as an experiment. At one point, the puppets were chasing on stage another puppet, and we thought, what if we stopped the soundtrack and got off the proscenium stage, went around to where the audience was, and go through the audience with the puppets, and the puppets would ask the parents as well as the small children, did you see where he went? Because we're trying to catch him. So we tried that. We stopped the soundtrack, and we continued the scene. And my puppet and yours and a few others would ask the audience, where did you go? Where did he go? Did you see him? And the kids got very excited and became part of the process of the chase. And I remember even the parents got very excited and were talking to my puppet saying, I think he went that way, and were pointing to part of the audience. It was a lot of fun. At some point, I'd like to continue that kind of genre of actually making the audience part of the action. I thought that worked really well. What do you think?
It's a good technique, and it works well with a lot of shows. It depends on the style of the show, but the one we were doing, it's a lot of fun, and it really does get the kids excited, and it gets the kids involved. So, yeah, it works very well. As I say, it depends on the type of show you're doing.
Yeah, I love that part of the show, too. That was one of my favorite parts, to do that. And what a great experience that was. Now, tell the audience that you are, if I can ask you this, that you're working on a new show. Can you give us some idea of what it's about?
I don't want to say too much about it because it would give too much away, but it's...
Okay.
It fits in with a lot of things. It's about aliens coming in and having infiltrated the Earth for a very long time, and they finally make their play to take over the Earth. And it's it's very silly, and it's a lot of fun. It involves different types of puppetry. There's hand puppets, shadow puppets, breakaway puppets. There's about five or six different types of puppets in it. And what also makes it fun, there are human characters and animal characters. So the humans are played by humans. The animals are played by puppets. So it's a really nice blend.
Absolutely. It sounds like a lot of fun. I'm certainly looking forward to seeing that production take place. That really sounds like a lot of fun to do and to see that. And hopefully later in the year you will have something. Have you ever thought of actually videotaping the puppet production, the next one you're doing?
I would like to videotape it as a preview and as an archive. But at least in my opinion, puppetry is something that should be done live.
It just adds a whole wonder to it. It does.
I could see
it
videotaping it and would make a lot of sense for so that it can reach more people. And shows that are designed, like they're designed for TV, like the Bears used to do, they were wonderful, and that was the medium they were going for. But I think you have to design it to the medium.
Okay. Understood. Now, for the listeners out there, if you would like to ask Hal or myself a question, or you have a comment that you'd like to run by us, we totally invite you to do that. I'm going to give you my email address, and you could address that email to either me, Nick, or to Hal, and ask whatever question you have or a comment if you'd like to do that. I'm going
to
give you now my email address.
Love to hear from you.
We absolutely would. Now, my email address is nicknyny1, and that's not O-N-E. It's the figure, the numeral one. So it's nicknyny1@gmail.com. Again, Nick. NYNY1@gmail.com. We certainly would love to hear from you. Now, Hal, we only have a few minutes left. Could you just give us some final thoughts on puppetry and so forth?
An amazing evolving art. It started out as shadow puppets. It went from hand puppets to marionettes. And, just a fun little bit of trivia. Marionettes started when they were in France, Little Mary, because it was illegal for humans to portray the royal, the Holy Family. And so they used puppets instead. But it's a wonderful evolving art from, standard puppets to computerized puppets. It's just a lot of fun to do. And it's amazing to try all these new and really neat techniques. It's just such a wonderful growing field.
It really is, and it's only limited by your imagination, which I love, and also it's the kind of thing that you can do without a gigantic budget. You can do stories, and you can make puppets, and you can get a production together, and it's not like an impossible amount of money at all. So it's very accessible to a lot of people, including children, as well as younger people, as well as teenagers and even adults, of course. Hal, I saw something on YouTube that I was very impressed about. What was that program recently that looked like a combination of live actors and puppetry working together? Do you remember that? It was from London.
It's called Spitting Image. It's political satire show, and it's very funny and very well done.
Incredibly well done. I've never seen anything quite like it, and to my surprise, that's been running for many, many, many years, I believe in London, and now it's on YouTube, and it is quite something, the way that they kind of married living actors with puppetry and robotics, electronics. And it's a combination. And spitting image means that the puppets are famous people, either from politics or other areas that you would recognize immediately. And there's a lot of wonderful humor involved, some biting humor involved. And so spitting image on YouTube, look it up. And I think that you'll find hours of wonderful entertainment by taking a look at that. I got to ask our producer, are we about at the end of the program?
Pretty much. You have maybe 2.5 minutes before they start saying 90 seconds, 60 seconds, and so forth.
Okay. All right. Very good.
See, that's
also one of the
wonderful things about puppetry. Puppets can say a lot and get away with saying some of the most wonderful or all different types of things that if you said them as a person, you might get your face slapped or they'd look at you in horror. But being a puppet, it's fine. It's fun. And a lot of times, little kids who are having all sorts of major, major problems will speak to a puppet a lot more than they will to a person. So they can be used for a lot of fun and some giving kids the very serious help they need.
I've been witness to that. You're absolutely right, and that's a wonderful quality of this particular medium. Hal, it's been such a pleasure to have you on my program. I look forward to your creative thinking in the months to come, years to come, and your productions. I just look so much forward to working with you on them and also to viewing them. I really look forward to that. I thank you so much for being on my podcast tonight.
Oh, it has been my pleasure. Totally my pleasure.
And so there you go. So this is Nick Curto for The Creative Process, wishing you all an enlightened and exciting journey as you find your own path to deepening your own creativity energies and more fully developing your talents in whatever many areas and expressions of life that take you. Till next time, embrace your creativity. Absolutely stay safe and be very, very kind to one another. Goodbye for now. Much love to you all. Take good care, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
Bye-bye. Thanks again, Nick and Hal. I learned a lot about both of you, and I learned a lot about puppetry. So it was an awesome hour. Thank you very much.
Pleasure.
And thanks to everybody who tuned in, whether you tuned in live by telephone or by computer, or whether you're going to join us later on and listen on demand. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. We're going to close with Linnell Griffin's musical creativity with Mighty Elohim.
This is the spirit.